Lecture 2. Empire Builders, the Persians.
Welcome back. As you remember from last time, it's our mission today to try to get to know the Persians, to get to know them on their own terms and even in their own language. This is something we've only been able to do over the past couple of centuries, and it's thanks to the translation of a remarkable document of ancient Persian that was made by a young English adventurer named Henry Rawlinson, who first saw this inscription in the 1830s when he was just 25 years old and a soldier in the East India Company. The inscription is at a place called Behistun, B-E-H-I-S-T-U-N, the Behistun Rock. If you start at Baghdad, or ancient Babylon, which lies near it, and take the road eastward, toward the old summer capital of the kings of the Medes, Ecbatana, where the road rises up into the hills, there are immense cliffs. And the last of these great cliffs, 1,700 feet high, has on it, for the last 2,500 years, a sort of a Mount Rushmore-type relief carving. But unlike Mount Rushmore, it also has an inscription. People down on the road below for centuries have looked up 300 feet and seen this high polished rock, these figures carved on it, something floating in the air above, and then all those hundreds of lines of inscription in what they could tell, even from way down there, is a script called cuneiform. Cuneus is the Latin word for a wedge. And cuneiform is the kind of script that was developed in Mesopotamia, where writing was done on little tablets of moist clay with a stylus that had a thin triangular-shaped point. And the scribes would punch those little triangles, those wedge shapes, into the tablets and put them in different configurations and use them as we use the alphabet. So cuneiform is a script in which you can write many languages. And as they looked up there, they could see all those things, but you couldn't get up and look closely because the stonecutters who made it, when they finished, as they came down the cliff, they chiseled away the steps by which they had been used to go up and make the inscription and show the relief. So within a few centuries of it being created in the time of the great kings of Persia, the identity of the figures was lost and what the inscription said was forgotten. There were different theories about it. One was that it was Queen Semiramis of Assyria, shown as a triumphal victor. Another was that it dated from Christian times and it was the 12 apostles talking to Jesus because there was a row of small figures in front of a big one. And a third idea was that it was a king of Assyria, Shalmaneser, shown in front of the captive Jews. He had conquered the Israelites of the northern kingdom and carried them off into an Assyrian captivity long before the Babylonians conquered Jerusalem and carried the Judean Jews away to Babylon to captivity. And this was supposed to be, by people who had a very bibliocentric view of the past, that act represented on the Behistun Rock. Well, in 1835, this young Englishman, Henry Rawlinson, not a scholar, not an academic, had not had a brilliant career at school, but he'd had one thing, a gift for languages. And he'd had, I guess, a second thing. He'd been great at games. He was a very athletic young fellow. He joined the British East India Company at a time when they were trying to establish land route connections from the Mediterranean, which had become a sort of lake for the British Navy after Admiral Nelson's victory at the Nile over the French, across the central part of the Near East and Middle East, to India, which at that time was controlled by the British East India Company, but everyone could see the time when it would be absorbed into a proper British empire. So Henry Rawlinson is an empire builder. And he came to this place on this great road, and he looked up and he saw the cliff, and it instantly entered his mind. People who've been trying to crack the code of this lost cuneiform writing system have only had tiny inscriptions, individual tablets, strips of metal, a bit of cuneiform on a pot. Here are hundreds of lines. And he could see that it was in three zones. And this immediately put him in mind of the famous Rosetta Stone. It had been in his lifetime that a French scholar, Champollion, had taken the Rosetta Stone found by Napoleon's troops in the delta of the Nile River, and seeing that the top was Egyptian hieroglyphs, The middle register was Egyptian demotic script, and the bottom was Greek, which half the officers in the French army could read at sight. They realized that the Greek would provide the clue to interpreting or cracking the code of the other two scripts. This is what Rawlinson thought. And he knew from his linguistic studies that fairly recently, documents of a language called Old Persian that went all the way back to Cyrus and Darius and Xerxes, the great conquering kings, it had been found in the Middle East as the holy book, the Avesta, A-V-E-S-T-A, the Avesta of the Zoroastrian religion. Zoroaster was a great prophet. We're not sure exactly when he lived. He may have lived just shortly before Cyrus, the king, embarked on his career of conquest. He may be a mythical character. We don't know. But he left behind this book about the one God, the one true God, Ahura Mazda, the fact that you don't build temples to him or make statues of him. He's everywhere. He's in the air. His element is fire. His altars are portable, and fire burns atop them. And magi, an individual is a magus, and plural they are magi, they are his priests, and they carry the fire altars around. They read the heavens. The magi who show up in the Gospel of Matthew in the Christian tradition are these Persian, they're not kings at all, as they become called, the three kings of the Epiphany story. They are Persian wise men who interpret the heavens and have seen this star in the Bible story. They go all the way back 500 years to this time of Darius and Cyrus. Now, this Avesta had provided a gold mine of the old Persian language. It was now quite well known. It had close relations to modern Iranian tongues. And so Henry Rawlinson immediately thought, with that much script and some idea of what might be in the inscription itself, I may be able to crack this code. He knew that other scholars in other countries were working on it, that proposals had been made. Nobody had been able to prove anything or convince everyone else. He made it his mission in life to crack cuneiform and read Persian. He got up there. He did some free climbing. He got up that sheer rock face. He realized that there were, as on the Rosetta Stone, three inscriptions. We now know that there was Old Persian, Elamite, which is an unrelated language of the territory of Elam, a kingdom which included the great city of Susa, which became the Persian capital. And at the bottom was Babylonian, which was a sort of lingua franca of Mesopotamia. So he made a transcription of the whole thing, line by line by line, character by character. Very tough to do when you don't know what the characters actually mean. He could tell that the languages were quite different because it didn't need nearly as many lines and characters in one language as in another to express the same thought. And over the next set of years, he began to work with his transcriptions of these remarkable documents. He was helped by the fact that it was a royal Persian inscription. And the kings of Persia were very vainglorious and very proud of their titles. And a typical inscription would read, and he knew this from reading his Herodotus, because Herodotus records inscriptions and proclamations by the kings of Persia. Typical one would read, "Darius, great king, king of kings, successor of Cyrus, great king, king of kings, and Achaemenid." And this royal house, this clan of kings of Persia, all claim descent from this original forebear, Achaemenes, so they call themselves the Achaemenid kings. Well, he realized that if it is a Persian royal inscription, and he thought it was, then if there was a short word that was repeated 5, 6, 7 times in the opening preamble, that word was king. And he knew what the word was in Old Persian. It was a word related to shah. It's got more of a kshah kind of a sound to it. The H's are sort of guttural. It's still around in the word checkmate, which was shahmat, which means the king is dead. It's sometimes thought that chess itself might be a Persian game that got transmitted to India. At any rate, he had no trouble at all in seeing that in the opening of one of these things that he had decided was Old Persian, there was that short word again and again and again. Now he says, which king is it? Because that word immediately gave him the phonetic equivalence for a short set of the cuneiform signs. He said, which king am I dealing with? Well, Kurosh, Cyrus, and his son Cambyses, and his father Cambyses, it all begins with the same letter, the Greek kappa, K. Well, whoever this king was, he had a different name from his father because he knew that they always start with themselves and then go on to their father. So it can't be Cyrus or Cambyses. The logical next one was Darius, Dariavash. So in this way, he was able to get more and more letters and ultimately translate the whole inscription. What he learned was it was a picture in relief of the great king Darius, shown gigantic, holding his bow in his left hand, as a proper Persian warrior would, with his foot on the neck of a fallen enemy and nine enemies strung out in front of him in a long line, the last one wearing a funny sort of dunce's cap. It was a scene of the story behind the accession of Darius. Great King Cyrus, who we met last time and who we'll be reverting to learn his story, he was not a founder of a dynasty. He was simply the one who propelled his dynasty onto the world stage. He had a legitimate son, Cambyses, who followed him, and just as Cyrus had conquered the Medes, had conquered Lydia, as we saw last time, had conquered Babylonia and died trying to conquer Central Asia, his son Cambyses was also a great conquering king. He brought Egypt, one of the richest kingdoms of the ancient world, into the Persian Empire. But when Cambyses died, there was a sudden hiatus. The claim was made that the rightful king had been killed, the rightful heir had died, a young man named Smerdis. And this warrior from the same family, the Achaemenid family, named Darius, decided to make himself king. Well, it was a time of chaos. There were many claimants, and he had to overcome the armies of those other nine and get them to swear fealty to him as the new king. That was what the rock at Behistun showed. It was sort of the declaration of legitimacy of the new great king, who was not a descendant of Cyrus. But he was a descendant of that original forebear, Achaemenes, and that was his claim, and that is what is up there for all to see. The stonemasons had chiseled away the steps so nobody could ever get at his monument and deface it. Whenever you put up a proclamation in the ancient world, you're always worried that someone's going to chisel it away, as, for instance, was done to the pharaoh Hatshepsut in Egypt when she left such a bad name behind her that her successors actually made sure that her name was chiseled off the monument. Darius made it impossible for that to happen. Now, I want to read you a little bit of this old Persian to give us a sense of these people, both in their time of glory, when their rulers had become kings of the world, and then as they were before that happened, because there was a great shift in their personality at that time. Let's start with the kind of thing that Darius would have said himself, apparently on any and all occasions. That strange thing floating in the air in the scene on the rock is in fact the god Ahura Mazda in a sun disk with wings floating above the scene to give legitimacy to his appointed ruler on earth, great King Darius. And from that Zoroastrian book, the Avesta, we know a lot about Ahura Mazda and his worship. And we know it was a monotheistic religion in a way, but to deal with the Persians, who were very tolerant of other religions, modern scholars of religion have had to invent a new word, henotheism, H-E-N-O theism, for monotheists who are nonetheless willing to tolerate and accept the polytheistic religions of others. So I mentioned last time, Cyrus is the king who was so beloved of the Jews because when he conquered Babylon, he freed the Jews from their captivity, sent them home. He did more than that. He gave orders that the Persian treasury should pay for the rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem. Well, that's not the act of someone who thinks, my God is the only God and only those are right who are worshiping him. Here is the voice of Darius. Great Ahura Mazda, greatest of gods, he created Darius the king. He bestowed upon him the good kingdom, possessed of good charioteers, of good horses, of good men. This idea of the good, the truthful, the light, is an essential part of the Zoroastrian religion, which sees the universe as a place of battle, of warfare, between the forces of light and the forces of darkness. That flowed into a later cult of a god named Mithras, took the Roman Empire by storm, became very popular with its legionaries who liked the feeling that you could be a soldier on a religious front, fighting for light against the powers of darkness. And let's face it, it's still with us today. Christianity has a hard time keeping this Zoroastrian idea out, because in a world where there's an absolutely supreme God, darkness really shouldn't have any particular chance to threaten him. So this idea, this grandeur, this pride, this clankety-clank proclaiming voice that we hear in most Persian inscriptions is a great contrast to the oldest parts of the Avesta, which seem to us to go back to a time before Cyrus, to a time when the Persians were a nomadic or farming people in those upland valleys, living in a hard land, leading a hard life among their tribes. This is one of the early passages from the Avesta. To what land shall I flee? Where bend my steps? I am thrust out from family and tribe. I have no favor from the village to which I belong, nor from the wicked rulers of the country. How then, O Lord, shall I obtain thy favor? I know, O wise one, why I am powerless. My cattle are few. I have few men. This could be a psalm of David at the time when he was on the outs with King Saul of Israel and trying to make his way in the wilderness. It is a voice we will not meet again in the Achaemenid inscriptions. The great kings quickly become wrapped around with ceremony as superhuman beings. But it's important to get back to it and remember the kind of people the Persians were when they embarked upon their rampage of conquest. They were, in fact, cousins of the Greeks. And when Cyrus, the king of Persia, stood in Sardis in his audience hall and talked to that Spartan herald who would come over to demand that Cyrus leave the Greeks of Asia in peace, it was cousin speaking to cousin. 1,000 or 2,000 years before that meeting, their ancestors had been together in Central Asia, in the land between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, the Caucasus Mountains. They were the Indo-Europeans, a family of human people speaking common languages that has really only been known about since the 18th century, when British in India realized that Sanskrit sounded an awful lot like German, and the whole idea of evolving languages and splitting into new languages from a common root became part of our view of history. The Indo-European languages have many different branches. Greek is a strange and anomalous one, a small group who got down through the Balkans and into modern Greece. We're going to be talking about them next time. The Persians were part of the mainstream. The great Iranian family ran all the way from the Ukraine and Russia, where the Scythians spoke a form of Iranian, all the way to Central Asia and the high plateaus that border the western side of the Himalayas. That's all this province of this one language, and the Persians probably could make themselves understood to most of the people who they met. The Medes, their neighbors, also spoke one of these Iranian tongues. The basis of Indo-European life was horseback riding, and the idea that as a mounted warrior, you could go wherever you wanted on these oceans of grass that were the steppes of Central Eurasia. This carried over into almost all of their descendants. All of these people believe that warriors are cavalry, horsemen, knights, and they give an aristocratic kind of respect to a horseman. And of course, this made them very formidable conquerors as they came sweeping down, very mobile, very hard to predict where they would hit next. They gradually took over the world that had been colonized and ruled for so long by the Semitic peoples like the Babylonians and the Assyrians, the older people like the Sumerians and the Egyptians. These new Indo-Europeans, led by folks like the Hittites and the Mitanni, become forces in the world with their horses. So the Greeks had forgotten that they had much in common with the Persians, but in fact, they had a lot in common. And the Persians, living down in their highland valley, down near the Persian Gulf, had maintained a lot of that traditional Indo-European way of life. It was not an urban culture from the beginnings. It was a countryside kind of culture, some farming, but mainly nomadism with these herds of cattle and horses, I said last time. And a great respect for these military leaders, these chiefs, because tribe was always against tribe. Family was against family, just as we heard in that little passage from the Avesta. Boys were brought up in the Persian way in a very simple system. You learned three things: ride hard, shoot straight, and tell the truth. That was the essence of Persian education. And they were somewhat anti-intellectual. As you can see, their religion is quite simple and straightforward also. God is there and he is to be worshipped. There is not an elaborate, confusing theology. The ceremonials are simple. There is no temple. There is no elaborate statue of a god. All of this gave a certain clarity and simplicity and beauty to the Persian way of life that the Greeks and other subject peoples were very impressed by. And the fact that they were so fast in those early generations, that Cyrus could be down in his little corner of Anshan country by the Persian Gulf in 1 year, and shortly thereafter be knocking at the gates of Sardis, half a world away, almost 2,000 miles away in the western parts of Asia Minor. This made them seem like supermen and was part of their mystique. It also is a little hurtful to us as we try to understand them, because the Greeks, who loved to tell stories, would weave myths around the Persians. Cyrus himself became a character we see more through myth than we do through history. We're going to encounter midway through the course a man named Xenophon, an Athenian who led a group of 10,000 mercenary soldiers in the wake of a Persian prince, coincidentally also named Cyrus, all the way to the heart of the empire to make that Persian prince the next king. Xenophon worshipped the Persians. He wrote the world's first historical romance on the boyhood of Cyrus, the Cairopaideia of Cyrus, to describe in his imagination how you would create the perfect ruler. And he took a little bit of an authentic Persian tradition, a mass of folklore and mythology, and added it to that. So it's going to be our job now to try to strip away the myths and see the Persians as they were and talk about Cyrus, the man who projects them out of their traditional homeland and onto the world stage. The Greeks told a lot of myths about Cyrus's boyhood. He reminds me of George Washington, and more people know the cherry tree myth than they do any of the authentic stories about his actual upbringing. Cyrus was like that. He seemed larger than life, so they gave him a larger than life background. They said that his grandfather, the king of the Medes, Astyages, had a dream in which he saw that his daughter, who'd married this Persian, was going to bear a son who would flow from her and engulf the world. And his interpreters told Astyages, king of the Medes, this means you are in danger from the son that will be born to your daughter. So just as in the Oedipus myth, and probably with no more historical foundation, he ordered the infant baby to be taken from the young mother, his own daughter, and given to a minister with orders to kill the child so that it couldn't grow up and threaten him. Well, of course, just as in Oedipus, you can't trust people to carry out this kind of inhuman demand. And in fact, the minister ensured that the baby was brought up, that Cyrus did in fact grow up to become the leader of his own people, the Persians, now having a mother who is one of the Medes, and then a family line going back to Achaemenes in his own valley. What did Cyrus do? And this is probably historical. He motivated and united the Persians. One of the problems that they'd always had is the problem that tribal people inevitably have of divisiveness. They have a little bit of that love of freedom and liberty and no one will tell me what to do that we talked about last time for the Greeks. Cyrus somehow overcame that. He infused them with a feeling of vision that somehow they had the right way of life. They were the toughest people and it was right that they should rule over others. It was a short step from that to confronting their neighbors, the Medes, who had spent a century and a quarter conquering the central part of the ancient world, what the Greeks called the Empire of Upper Asia, reaching from the Halys River in Asia Minor all the way to beyond Mesopotamia. And once they had combined with the Medes, and remember, he's the grandson of the king of the Medes, so Cyrus has royal Median blood. It makes it easy for people to shift their allegiance to his line. He then begins to expand on that empire, first going up to Lydia and conquering it, and of course getting those Greek city-states into his empire that are going to be the source of all the trouble to come. But then he goes down to Babylon, and here we see a new element that's a part of the unique Persian nature. Enormous engineering works. How to get into Babylon? Towering walls, tremendous supplies of food inside. The Babylonians would come up on the walls of the city and shout and laugh at Cyrus outside, who was trying to take their city. Engineering. A former queen, Nitocris, had created a great reservoir above Cyrus, above Babylon, where the Euphrates River flowed through the city. He diverted the river into the reservoir and sent in some of his men on the dry riverbed to get inside and open the gates. This was the famous occasion recorded in the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, where the prophet Daniel is inside, one of the captive Jews, and he tells Belshazzar, the ruler in Babylon, that he can interpret the handwriting on the wall at Belshazzar's feast, and that it says, "You have been weighed in the balance and found wanting," and at those very moments, the Persians are coming into the city to take it over. Many Babylonians were glad that the Persians came. They had a reputation for justice. The Babylonians said, "Our god Marduk has appointed this Cyrus to rule us." Cyrus put a lot of money into refurbishing the temples in Babylon and then headed eastward. And he died trying to conquer another people like the Persians, horse lords of Central Asia called the Massagetae, who had a famous queen named Thomyris. Some of these mounted women warriors are probably those behind the legends of the Amazon in ancient Greek mythology. But he passed on to his son Cambyses this great empire. How to rule it? Well, they divided it up into provinces. Often these were the old kingdoms. They used the old royal capitals now to be their provincial capitals, and they called each one a satrapy. And now ruling each satrapy in the name of the great king is a Persian, almost always, sometimes a Persian of the royal house, of the Achaemenid line, who is the satrap. And we will be encountering these satraps again and again as we go along with our story. And their loyalty is always something the great king has to think about, because he's basically given to each one a kingdom. Satrap of Egypt, satrap of Lydia, satrap of Babylon. It's their job to keep those places peaceful, and this is, of course, what is the great benefit to anybody of being drawn into the Persian Empire. You don't have to worry about your neighbors anymore. You don't have to worry that an army's going to come out of nowhere and besiege your town and kill you, take away your family into slavery. The Persians guarantee peace within their borders. You are safe. You are secure. All you need to do is pay your taxes, pay your tribute, and all will be well. How do you keep this vast area together? More engineering. The royal roads. These were limited access highways where people had to present passports at the way stations all along the way, where there were guards to check everybody's papers. If you were an ambassador, if you were a special envoy, if you were an army on the move, if you were anyone sent by the great king or on the great king's business, you had a right to be on that royal road. The ordinary caravan routes went elsewhere. These were not sort of mass trunk roads with all kinds of traffic on them. There was a pony express that carried the king's messages from way station to way station along the great road. The one most familiar to the Greeks was the road from Sardis, the old capital of Lydia, all the way to Susa, 1,600 miles away. And Herodotus, who records for us the way stations along the road and how long it was, marveled at these riders who made their way along that with a speed unknown to anything else that moved on the surface of the earth, carrying the king's dispatches to his satraps in those distant capitals. It's a fascinating thing that the motto of these riders of the king on the royal road is still with us today. And I'd like to end with that today, because I think it sort of sums up that quality of relentlessness, that quality of simplicity, of duty, and pride in achievement that is the essence of these Persians that we've come to know today. You can see it engraved on any U.S. post office, because it has become the motto of our postal service also. Neither snow, nor rain, nor heat, nor dark of night shall stay these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. There you have, in a nutshell, everything that made the Persians what they were. A people to be feared, but above all, a people to be respected and marveled at. People who could seem to overcome time and space. People to whom the challenges of nature were simply obstacles to be overcome. And as they begin to set out to deal with these Greeks on their western borders, Greeks who we will get to know in our next lecture, we can see all of those extraordinary characteristics at work.